Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Sales Effectiveness Radio, brought to you by the Semantics Group. Now here's your host, Steve Maul.
Hey, welcome everyone to another episode of Sales Effectiveness Radio. I'm here with my in-studio wingman, Lee Cantor, and my guests today are two extremely talented and experienced professionals in the world of selling, Jim Foster and Scott Sullivan. I have known Scott and Jim for, we were just talking about 35 years, so we go way, way back, and each of them have had a very varied approach to selling in their career. Paths have taken different paths than mine and each other's over the years. So what I'd like to do is give them each a chance to tell us a little bit about what they've been doing throughout their career, and then we'll dig into some sales effectiveness questions. Jim, tell us a little bit about where you're at in life.
Sure. Right now, I'm retired. I'm having a great time in life.
Now I'm jealous.
But now I'm still have my hands in there doing a little bit of consulting with private equity firms on reviewing their investment theses on different software companies. But, you know, I started off with you guys selling at McCormick & Dodge, and we were selling old mainframe software, and, you know, to do a demo was a nightmare. I can't even remember how hard it was to do a demo. I remember carrying a compact PC around and watching Scott drop one in the Atlanta airport and going, I don't know if we'll be doing a demo this next time. But it started off there, and I branched off from sales and moved into much more of a product management, and from product management moved into a startup, and did my first startup out of Florida, a company called Abracadabra Software. What a great name. We merged with Best Software and ended up selling it to Sage a long time ago for quite a few millions of dollars. You can look it up. We had an investment from a venture capitalist for about $5 million, and I think the return for the investor was 400x.
That's a nice return.
It was pretty good, and it was a lot of fun. But in there is where I learned about sales effectiveness with a third-party channel. We used business partners,
okay.
And that was really interesting because, you know, we used to have a saying, you can lead a business partner to a gold brick, but you can't make him pick it up.
I like that play on it.
It's a real interesting. So we did that and worked with Sage for many, many years, and then had an opportunity to move as a CEO of a consumer product, or actually a small business consumer product, where we sold, it was called Neat.
Yeah, the automatic scanning software. And yep.
Absolutely, yeah. And the key secret sauce with that was it not only just scanned, but it did the OCR and determined what kind of document it was. Was it a bill? Was it an invoice? Was it a receipt?
Right.
And then applied it to a specific application. We sold that to very, very small businesses. I mean, you know, one of the most interesting aspects of selling that one was ran into one of our customers in South Carolina, believe it or not. I happened to have to return a tool from my brother, and this guy was out in the middle of nowhere. He said, I asked him what he did. He said, I'm a long hauler. You know, I said, a long hauler. Yeah, I drive a truck from New York to wherever. And I said, he said, you won't see my rig? Yeah, and I'm out in the middle of nowhere.
Everyone's proud of what they drive.
Yeah, and I'm out in the middle of nowhere, and there's no way I was going to say no. So I said, yeah. So I walk in there, and he opens up his cab, and there is one of our scanners.
So he's scanning everything as he drives.
He's scanning all of his receipts as he drives and integrating it directly into QuickBooks. And so we sold that, and that was my first experience of really seeing what it was like to integrate web marketing with direct sales over the phone. Very, very interesting aspect, and, you know, it's still the same way of selling.
I have a finance manager who would love for me to be that organized with my receipts.
Anyway, we were successful with that, but I was traveling to and from Philadelphia for like 5 years, and that got old quick. And so we moved back to Atlanta and worked with a company called Logfire, who's now part of Oracle.
Okay.
And they had a international sales force. We worked with those, and I was chief operating officer there. And from there went into consumer marketing. You ever thought about that? I mean, we were marketing with Crown and Caliber, by the way. I'll put a plug in for those guys. If you're interested in a luxury used watch, go to crownandcaliber.com.
Okay.
I mean, you'll get the best deal without a doubt, and a guarantee that makes sure that your watch is really a low Rolex or really a Audemars Piguet or whatever it is you're into. And they've got several watchmakers on site. So
that's cool.
It's good stuff. But we learned a lot about how to market to consumers. What are the key things? How do you do financing? Stuff like that. Then went back in enterprise sales with Risk Connect, where we had to change the process for an enterprise sales force that was selling Fortune 1000.
Yeah.
It was really fun. A lot of fun. And we sold that business off to Tom Bravo.
Now, as you've gone through that career, Jim, you've had everything from frontline selling, sales management, sales leadership, operational management. I don't know if you're going to brag on yourself, but you were, an Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award winner for technology in 2013. And so you've had P&L responsibility. You've had teams of 20 people to 33,000 people. So you've had a lot of breadth and depth as you've looked at the way organizations sell, either direct or through channels. So I got one simple question. Why is selling still so hard?
Selling's hard because it's a discipline. I think Brad Milner taught us this a while back. And, for those of you who know Greg Doyle, I thought he was the one who adopted that discipline better than anyone I know. It's about if you maintain that discipline of looking at your pipeline, knowing that I got to build the front end, I got to make sure that I'm making the, even though I've got a monstrous month coming up, I got five big deals. five big deals that are coming in this month, and I know it's going to consume a lot of my time. Is the discipline to sit back on a Monday and pick up the phone and start hitting those early sales calls and early sales process. And if you don't follow up your leads, then you're just going to die later on. And that's the case in consumer. That's the case in, if I'm doing third party, I got to work that. It doesn't matter. It's the same thing.
So that's developing the rigor.
Yes.
Developing the habits. Yep.
Developing the habits. And then as you, and it's funny, I know you remember when we were taught that, you really got to find the quote decision maker, the influencer. And we had that process. And then when I went into consumer, I said, you don't have to go to that kind of rigor. Unfortunately, you still do. Really, in the consumer, who's going to be the one who's going to agree to the watch? Is it the wife? Is it the guy? And what is the obstacle around it? Is it my short-term cash flow? I need financing? All those same things happen in consumer.
Whether it's the CFO who says, I can afford this software suite or to build a parking garage, or it's the family who says, I can afford this watch or to send my kid to school.
No, it's different.
It's still the same decision-making process.
It is.
Now, what about the how today there's kind of a delegation of tasks, like somebody's in charge of the prospecting part, somebody's in charge of the demoing, somebody's in charge of the client success. Does the same rigor apply to each of those individually?
I think as you move down into from enterprise sales down to mid-market, down to using partners, down to consumer, it becomes one body rather than having multiple teams. But as you get more elaborate, more if the price point of what you're selling is above $20,000, you're going to need teams. And those teams and that handoff of those teams is very, very critical. And how you do that is why CRM was invented. As a consumer marketer, we actually implemented a CRM. But it wasn't used at the same level that you would see a team-based selling approach use a CRM. But it's still the same stuff. I still need to remember that I got to follow up this person. It's got to tickle me to do this and that type of situation. So the CRM is incredibly helpful. And, when I go into if a private equity firm asks me to evaluate a sales team, the first thing I'm looking at is, what are they using for CRM, especially in the enterprise space? If it's none, then I go, okay, we already got a problem.
But as that process goes through, to follow on to Lee's question, it it seems like it's going to dramatically increase the responsibility level at each of those stages, at each of those individuals involved, because if one person falls down in their rigor or in their performance, then the entire team suffers.
That's absolutely correct. And so the transfer process, how much process have you put in place for transferring the movement from the lead generation team over to the qualification team or AFP team? How much rigor have you put into it? In other words, do they just sit down and have a chat? Well, that's not enough rigor. You know, is there an actual form that we fill out? Form, I'm talking about online form, that we fill out that makes sure that certain key components of the sales cycle have been met at 100% so that it can move to the next stage. And the guy that is receiving it or the person that is receiving it has to be diligent to say, you haven't gotten enough stuff done, I'm kicking it back. If he's too greedy and says, I'll take it from here, then that's where the process really falls down.
Okay.
And when you're doing kind of an audit of a company and you're looking at their process, how are you kind of finding the bottlenecks and where the problems lie?
Usually you'll see it in a pipeline analysis. If you look at a pipeline analysis, extremely bloated in the back end, on the front end. And you see it looks, instead of looking like a pipeline, it looks like a tack. And you're sitting there going, okay, there's something wrong going on here. So there's not enough processes in that place. So really just looking at the pipeline analysis is a good way of a first start to see where problems may lie.
You probably have to vet that pretty significantly too, because I know a lot of pipelines I look at, they look like a top, not the tack. You know, everything's down. Oh, it's all ready to close.
Yeah.
Which means I've done all my selling steps, but the customer is still back up to evaluating their options. And so they're not ready to buy, regardless of how ready to sell you happen to be.
Yeah, the salesman's always ready to sell,
or
the customer's not ready to buy. Again, it's the rigor in each one of those processes. You know, especially if you're heavily in professional services with your software solution, you know, have you done the right things in the middle stage to realize how big of a professional services implementation this is going to be? In some cases, you're going to look at it and go, we're not going to make any money on the PS. The implementation is going to drown this. We're not going to see a profitability on our recurring revenue until year two or year three. You know, you got to make a decision. Is that worth chasing for the next 6 months? So looking at that handoff, looking and making sure that the process in between stages is very detailed and very disciplined.
And Jim, what else, because you mentioned CRM, and you know, it's often the bane of every salesperson in existence to have to keep CRM up to date. And there's a lot of, I hear a lot from the people I work with that, geez, this is for management. And I do my best to try and persuade them it's actually for your success as well. But that's one of those gold bricks that you can't make them pick up necessarily. but it's one of those things where beyond CRM, what else can companies do to enable their, and I don't even like the phrase sales enablement, I'll tell you why in a moment, but to enable their selling teams to be more effective?
You know, again, it's looking at the process and throwing away the things in the process that are just there because we've had them there for years. Many of the times I'll walk into a sales organization, look at it and go, why are you doing that? Well, we've been doing that for 5 years. Well, what value does it bring? I'm not sure. Someone down the line may have it. Yeah. No, it doesn't bring any value. Don't do it. You know. So streamlining those processes so that it gives the salesperson the amount of data that they need. And usually that's translated into the data that management needs. There's never, if you really go back from the top and come down and say, here's data that management needs, why is that important to the sales rep? You can usually point to it. It is very important to the sales rep. And by selling the sales rep on that, it's pretty easy.
Now, you mentioned earlier about third-party partners. Is that handled differently because you're dealing with outside resources like that?
Yeah, in this case, your sales team is really a sales management team. And so they're trying to manage these folks who are not necessarily monetarily motivated. they may be motivated by other things. They may have a consulting arm that they're seeing as their most profitable venture. And they were probably the worst of let me sell and then go back and look for new leads. Let me sell, then go back for new leads. So it's up to the sales team who's selling to the business partner to keep them focused on you got to go generate, you know, even though you got four going to close, you got to set up a seminar so that you can bring some new customers in or new prospects in and keep that momentum going. They're the worst at that.
So that leads me to two follow-on questions, the first of which is, do you, in your experience, do you see those partner managers, those third-party channel managers, do you see them being recruited, engaged, hired, and performing as really sales managers? Or do you find that sometimes the organization relegates them to caretaker of the relationship type of thing?
Well, we did it in two different ways. I mean, we started off with one person having the role of everything. In other words, I got to find new business partners. I got to grow those new business partners. I got to educate those new business partners. And we quickly realized that just like anything else, you got hunters and farmers.
Right.
So we separated the let me recruit the business partners guy to get them to a 6 month and get them to the first two deals. And then they transfer it over to another person who was really maturing the relationship. So you got to mature. They're just two different skill sets, just like, you know, in selling back to the customer versus getting new business.
And the expectation management, because the seller within the third party organization has a sales manager that they work for. And so now do you find that sometimes they feel like they're serving two masters, or how do you manage around that?
Yeah, they do feel like you're serving two masters, and they'll say, look, you know, you need to get off my back. And then, well, we don't need to get off your back, because if you don't hit this, and again, we set quotas for the business partners like anything else. If you don't hit this, your margin is going to drop from 40% to 20%.
Right.
And that's really going to affect your P&L. And I can go back to the owner, which we talked about, and let them know that's the case. Oh, no, we don't want you to do that.
Right.
Right. So you got to make sure you got to have both the stick and the carrot.
Or a stick in the shape of a carrot.
That's good. <Yeah. laughs>
So how do people get a hold of you if they want to get some of your pearls of wisdom on a personal level?
And you're looking for relationships with VC firms? Is that?
I have relationships with private equity firms mainly, and one VC firm out of New Jersey. You know, I'm not really looking for anything. I'm really looking for new golf courses. Any VCs or anyone out there that private equity firms that want to work with me, typically on the work with GLG, a few other third parties who go out and find experts. But if they want to get a hold of me directly, it's jim@jimfoster.org.
Great. Thank you. And we'll hear back from you when we open up the roundtable in just a moment.
Great.
So let's turn our attention to Mr. Sullivan here. Scott, tell me a little bit about what Altria does.
Altria is an enterprise contract lifecycle management solution from request to renewal. And all phases within that particular suite. So things like requesting a mutual NDA to be auto-generated, the authoring, templates, clause management, as well as post-award analytics. So I've worked really hard to get this contract in the door. Everybody's agreed to it. Now what? How do I measure and monitor the effectiveness of the agreement that people thought to put into paper?
Okay.
Being able to look at SLAs, looking at milestones, looking at entitlements and obligations with that particular agreement as well.
So cradle to grave on any type of contractual relationship between two firms.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And your job there, you would tell us a little bit about what you
do. I'm a regional sales manager. Okay. Since I left D&B Software way back in
forever
90,
ago.
91.
Yeah, forever ago.
I've been with 12 startups since then. So a wide range of enterprise software suites or solutions, doc management, workflow management, systems management, knowledge management, right. basically, anything that you could find in today's enterprise stack, I pretty much have sold or worked for companies that were trying to establish a presence in that marketplace, a new beachhead, so to speak.
So I know personally you've been successful in those. So it's, is it a situation of you get bored or you just want a new challenge? Or what's why are you a serial salesperson?
some of them, I picked the wrong date. It was, I didn't get her number either. Yeah. Others, there were successful exits, either acquisition or roll-ups into organizations. And in some cases, I did have a slice of equity in the firm. Others, I didn't. But it's been pretty fruitful. I enjoy the process. I really envision it as a challenge. So we're entering a marketplace. How do I get those beachhead accounts, those early adopters? And to Jim's point, your point, Steve, it's all about the rigor. I call it evidence-based selling.
Okay.
I don't move things through a funnel unless I have evidence that point A to point B has been accomplished, and I can prove it both internally as well as externally. And from an external perspective, some people might think this is risky, but I share the process that I go through to consummate a deal with a particular prospect just as well. You hope that they give you insight into their process, not necessarily the solution meeting their needs, but how do you get this done? Have you bought things like this before? Especially in today's world, there's a lot of people out there doing multiple jobs. They may never have bought an enterprise software solution. They're part of a project team. And it's kind of dead air when you say, well, how many times have you gone through this process before? And they kind of look at you, never.
Right.
So that adds another challenge where rigor and, you know, focus on how to move those things through the funnel, or, you know, the old adage is move it down or out.
Right. I mean, because even if they've bought enterprise software before, they probably haven't bought contract lifecycle management before. And so the players are different and the evaluation process is different and the criteria by which you're going to select is different. So the experience in a similar situation may not even add any value to their evaluation of your solution.
Right. And, you know, the interesting thing is when you start talking contracts and all of the vested parties at the table, people's dirty laundry comes out pretty quickly. Oh, the salespeople, or legal, or contracts, or services. It really is kind of amazing from a enterprise stack that this is really the last area of automation, or, you know, addressing what really is the lifeblood of an organization. Anything that happens in a business is really centered around an agreement.
Mm-hmm. Whether it's with employees or contractors or channels or customers or anyone else.
Exactly. Right.
So now, how do you vet the opportunities? How did you know Altria was right for you?
Well, I had come out of a supplier registration solution previous to Altria, and oddly enough, there was more than one time where the prospect or customer said, hey, you know, we want to extend this concept not only to our suppliers, but manage the relationship in terms of an agreement. So quite often I heard the request for contract management while I was performing my supplier registration representative duties. And the company I was with, Levante, was a recovery auditor type of organization that had a supplier registration system. They sold to PRGX here in town, and it was pretty apparent that this was going to be an ancillary type of solution. So I went out and started looking and assessing contract management solutions, and I found Altria that was looking for gray hair and experience.
Both of which you have.
So I'll mention that. You know, Jim's a little envious when you talk about head of hair.
Absolutely.
This is why we're on radio. The one of the things that you mentioned was that evidence-based selling, and that when you tie that into the rigor, I think that's one of the things that we don't see as often as we need to, because I mentioned it a little bit when I said, you know, the salespeople go through their process, and CRMs are generally spelled out to be the selling process. process. And the organizations I've seen do it best align all of that to buyer behavior, because it's the buyer's behavior that produces the evidence you're ready to move to the next step.
Right.
And so, but I don't see that happening as often as it needs to.
Well, I think it's a foreign concept to a large majority of the selling professionals in sales management. Well, I've got a 5-step sales funnel and we're going to check. And, you know, Bob over here thinks he feels really good that he can get it done by this day. Oh, well, have you done red lines? Have you gotten comments back? Do you even know something is simplistic? Is it their quarter end or our quarter end? Those, you know, those little tidbits of information kind of go into a kind of a portfolio of.
Has the customer told you you're on the short list?
Right.
You know, something
right.
as simple as that.
Right, right. And, you know, I think it, just from kind of a self-serving for the profession, that skill set, you can't read it. You can't attend a seminar. You got to get your head kicked in multiple times in evaluations to take a step back and say, oh, I missed this glaring hole in my execution of the strategy, or the client wasn't aligned, or prospective client wasn't aligned.
Now, is this something that you find that sales managers aren't coaching the person, and the salesperson has to learn this kind of the hard way? There's no way to kind of be taught some of these principles?
No, I think the coaching is a little lacking, so to speak. I think the sales professionals, you can be a flash in the pan, you know, have a great year, have the right territory, right individuals. The real question is, are you consistent?
Mm-hmm.
And are you building a franchise, if you will, if you look at a territory as a franchise, are you building that into a repeatable function? And am I writing good business for the company?
Right.
It's not just the fact that, hey, I got a contract for X $100,000. If there's deliverable problems, if there's, you know, shortcomings in that solution that you knew going in, it may not be the best profile contract for a company to bring in. And quite honestly, it's a really hard discipline to embrace, walking away from an opportunity that you've invested time. But as one of my mentors said, there's two winners in an RFP process, the one that gets selected and the one that gets out early.
Right, because you haven't spent all that time and energy giving away all your competitive knowledge, because you know if you give it all away, all your competitive differentiating statements and everything else, when you lose the deal, the winner is going to learn it.
Yeah.
That whole, I think you used the very eloquent phrase of get your head kicked in a couple of times. How?
Or I've been waxed more than a supermodel.
How? Stop it. How do you coach the people on your team and your colleagues, and how have you learned to do that debrief after your customer engagements to know whether or not you're hearing the things you need to hear?
Well, I think you have to take it upon yourself to document or put it into a framework. And once again, you have different parties within the organization, professional services, maybe a systems engineering group, if there's business development involved or partners, you have to take it upon yourself to make it simple, effective, and repeatable. And I call it 360-degree selling. You're selling out to the target audience, mm-hmm. but you're doing as much selling internally. And I kind of thrive in those environments. You know, you have to stand for something. You have to take, you know, hey, we should be doing this, or could we look at an extension to the product, even though it's not on the roadmap? Woo, you know? You have to take it upon yourself to really kind of do that 360-degree view.
So when you come back from a meeting with the customer, the debrief isn't how'd that call go, and they go, great, thumbs up, and you go, fantastic, let me know if you need anything. That's not an effective call debrief is what I'm hearing from you.
No, but you know, I think it's if you want to share, document it while it's fresh, or even there is some benefit to take a step back and let it sit for a while,
mm-hmm.
you know, a couple, 3 days before you document that information.
And you've mentioned the word repeatable multiple times. You find a lot of salespeople aren't creating repeatable processes. They're kind of winging it each time.
I think they're looking at, you know, selling by menu or selling by table of contents. Here's what I need to do. And each and, you know, the funny thing is, at the end of the day, you'll run into enterprise customers saying, hey, my problems are unique. No one in the world has this. And then when it comes time for reference, hey, give me a couple people that are doing just like I, using the system just like I would like to. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, if you have a product and a solution in the marketplace, it's incumbent as an ambassador to the company me to go find those and make sure that it's as efficient and as profitable as possible.
The other thing that you said earlier that I'd like to come back to for just a second is your transparency with the customer, because I think I have a great admiration for that approach. It's not like the customer doesn't understand what we're trying to do here. It's not like we're selling to them as a surprise. So letting them know the steps you're planning on going through seems like a pretty smart idea. So how do they typically react to that?
Well, it doesn't, you know, the first call, you don't walk in, hi, I'm Scott, how do you like me so far? But, you know, the bottom line is you have to build that level of trust. And I think being transparent, you know, sometimes you got to be willing to get burned by it. And, you know, you get something, you give something. It really does foster a relationship. And I've picked roles where there is that go sell it. Be the guy in the background during the implementation. If something goes wrong, you know, you dial 911, I'll pick up. So, right. You know, I think customers appreciate that, especially in today's world, because it is, you know, everybody's overworked, they're overscheduled, they can't get to certain things. And being a resource, if you will, for those individuals as they go through an implementation process.
And isn't that one of their fears, is that you're going to abandon them and they're going to have nobody to call? They want that call.
Yeah, there's a lot of cases of hit and run driving within the marketplace. And, you know, the fact that I pride myself that, you know, you could pick up the phone and call me. And I still have customers from 15, 20 years ago that they may not be buying my solution, but we still stay in touch to try to keep track of what's going on in their industry or what trends they're seeing in an enterprise software mode.
And undoubtedly, they're calling asking you for your advice or who they should call for a particular solution because you're so well-networked within the community.
Yeah, I think so. The biggest challenge I've had, though, being based here in Atlanta, is in these missionary roles, if you will. Typically, people ask, what's your territory? Well, you know, does it have a zip code, right?
Right.
You know, you typically are jetting across the country or Canada. So it's kind of hard from a proximity perspective to maintain those, you know, let's get together relationships. But, you know, with LinkedIn and email and, you know, those types of tools, those are really effective ways to stay in touch with people.
But I've known you to be one of the consummate networkers in my circle of people. You know, you remember everybody, you keep in touch with people, even if it's casually, even if it's not that frequent. And I think that's paid dividends to you.
Yeah, I think, you know, it, once again, it's a rigor, it's an attitude, you know. You know, I don't want to be known as the guy that just came in here and sold something, right?
Right.
You know, unless it was really successful and they really want to hire me.
So now for you in Altria, what are your challenges there?
Typically in the enterprise contract lifecycle management space, we're going against very established organizations such as SAP Ariba, Oracle, Coupa, as well as probably in the CLM space, if you did a broad brush, there's probably 50 to 60 alternatives within the marketplace. So it really, the rigor that I try to live by and execute is really kind of the differentiator, I think. You know, and probably my biggest weakness is walking away from an opportunity, right?
If it's not a right fit.
You don't know it's a right fit till you lose it, right? Or you have a support issue. But, you know, it's the old adage, no just means that the person's confused, right?
And yours is a SaaS solution, right?
Yes, it's deployed on Amazon.
So like most solutions in the marketplace today, at least in the enterprise software space, everything seems to be going to SaaS. Let's keep it all in the cloud. What's your experience, not necessarily with Altria specifically, but in general, what's your take on the SaaS movement and the effect of the challenges that salespeople face in that space?
Well, it's coming mainstream, obviously. You know, I think Salesforce was probably the number one promoter of that software as a service, obviously. It doesn't change. It just shifts the responsibility onto the provider. Mm-hmm. If you stop and look at on-premise solutions, you know, behind the scenes, there was the network guys, there were the hardware guys, there were the security guys. All of that now is, you know, upon the provider. I think the... If you take a look over even the last 3 or 4 years, especially in contracts, privacy and protected information 4 or 5 years ago might have been a slight mention in an agreement.
Right.
Now there's 8, 9, 10, 15 clauses within an agreement that we're executing or our prospective customers are executing. That is front and center now. And so you have to be aware of what PCI is, or proprietary information, or digital rights management. As crazy as it sounds, you have to be a jack of all trades, and once again, 360-degree selling.
Right.
We have to educate our internal folks as well as be aware or anticipate that it's a different ballgame right now as far as context is concerned. I personally believe selling SaaS solutions is a lot harder than it was selling on-premise mainframe or even client server-based solutions.
Because they're looking to the vendor to be the provider of security and database and communication layer and all of those sorts of things.
Yeah, you have to be a one-stop shop or at least understand the standards that are emerging.
Right.
As well as, you know, what type of theater are you going to deploy this? Is this a truly global installation? Well, North America is a lot different with Amazon Web Services than in the EU. And what's the driving factor? Well, privacy. Right,
GDPR.
Right, and you know we're seeing that in California now with California privacy rules, and I would predict in 3 to 5 years there will be a little bit more bite into a privacy standard in the U.S. or even North America.
Okay.
So now, when you're going to market with Altria and you're having these conversations, and they're asking for this kind of full suite solution from you, how do you manage that as opposed to, like you said, when it was just I was selling this thing, the software, and then I was done, and they had that, they understood that expectations, and now, so do you bring resources in, third party? How do you give them the education they need in order to make the buying decision?
Well, you know, education, we all know that teachers don't get paid crap, so you got to be pretty careful about that. But we have our own system engineering group. I think it goes back to being a resource. You go in and meet with people, say, hey, where's IT in this? What type of security concern? You know, you have to bring it up. You know, it's sometimes you're bringing up objections that you should need or should be able to address. But it's staying a couple steps ahead of the particular prospect. Now, some organizations, you know, this is the fourth or fifth SaaS solution that they've acquired. They've got it down to, pretty much an art. The thing that really has been a challenge at Altria is doing sandbox demo environments where people can get their hands on the system. There is, our motto is we configure for 100% of the marketplace, customize for zero. So with that configuration, even though it's a configure to order solution, there is some expertise to know which switches and, you know, how to build that configurable solution. And it becomes a pretty dangerous proposition when you turn over a sandbox to individuals. You know, we've gotten around that or addressed that head on by doing what we call proof of capabilities, where give us some of your documents. We'll set up some of your users. We'll run you through different scenarios. And then we'll proctor you or mentor you within a live demo session. That seems to work pretty effectively. You know, it each and every company is a little bit different about the approach, but pretty consistently, they're going to want to get their hands on it. You know, and I think it's a direct correlation to smartphone technology. Everybody can download an app and answer a few questions and boom, that you know, they're live on whatever app there is. You know, it's kind of not...
So that's their expectation.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, because for most everyone has, download a free trial. Well, right. This is a much more complex situation.
Right.
Even Salesforce, you can download a $5 a month or a version for yourself to play with if you wanted, and that... So the whole idea of that configurability has a level of complexity that's probably hard to overcome as an objection.
Yeah, it's, you know, the old adage is how does it know? Or, you know, we have an AI parsing engine on the front end. How does it pull out clauses and compare it to what are approved clauses?
Right.
And how do you scorecard that? You know, and interesting enough, one word could change the meaning of a clause.
Right.
The car is red. The car is not red. Right?
Right.
Semantic or text mining or text algorithms would say, hey, these are a close match, where in reality it's 100.
An apostrophe can change the meaning.
Right, right, right.
Because it talks about possession. So in general, and I want to make sure everyone knows how to get a hold of you too, Scott. So why don't you give them your contact information?
It's Scott Sullivan, and I have a very old email address. It's SSULLIVA@bellsouth.net.
Don't you love when they could only be 8 characters?
Yes.
And then what about Altria if somebody wanted to learn more about Altria?
It's Scott, SCOTT.Sullivan. @altria.com.
And that's ULTRIA.com.
Yes.
Yep. So they can hit the website or Scott. Great. Let me open the floor to just a general question, because we've got a bunch of gray-haired guys here sitting at the table pontificating about what life used to be like when we had to walk uphill both directions to school in 10 feet of snow. So as we're thinking through, you know, some of our listeners, and some of those guys and gals might be significantly younger and newer in the profession than we are, what do you think is the you know, we heard about rigor and discipline, and I love all of that, but if somebody was to take away one lesson from today, is that it, or is there something else that we should be passing along as advice to people as sales professionals to be more effective in the way they interact with their customers and achieve success in the profession?
Well, I think the number one thing is be professional. Execute, have a plan, you know, even though your comp plan or your territory plan or how you sell things has already been predetermined, how are you going to attack it? And you have to do it in a repetitive rote means. It's, you know, don't look at your forecast once a month or you got a QBR coming up. It's every day, as Jim mentioned earlier. What do I need to do to move this? You know, where are my holes? Where are my risks? Where are my blind spots? It at the end of the day, it boils down to building a relationship. And if there's other parties in the relationship, you need to bring them along, you know, and other parties could be consulting services, your own, or consulting services through a partner, as well as systems engineers, but also the people that are on the other side of the table that you're trying to strike an agreement with.
Yep.
You know, I think Scott said something earlier that just really resonated with me about the transparency of the deal. You know, the more you can help the user buyer influence, for lack of a better term, understand what is the best process for you to go through and make a decision, and not do it in such a way as it's tainted towards your offering. It's more on the lines of, let me help you do your job. And if you're doing that, you're getting a good relationship mm-hmm. with that user and helping them make that decision. And as you're doing that, you can throw in a little few hints that, you know, you need to be really concerned about X, where X is probably my biggest strength.
Right.
And let me tell you why you might want to. Tell me why that wouldn't be important to you and stuff like that. But really relating to that person, knowing that they are sweating bullets because they have a normal 8 to 9 job, 8 to 9 o'clock at night. And now we're adding 2 to 3 more hours on them to do an evaluation. And that's a stressful opportunity.
And if they make the right choice, they get their picture in the company newsletter.
That's
right. And
if
they make the wrong choice,
they get their picture on LinkedIn.
Right. Yeah. They get to spend more time with their family. Yeah. Special projects awaits them. Yeah, it is. It's a career-limiting move sometimes, depending on an enterprise-wide decision where they're literally spending millions of dollars for the software, even more than that for the implementation. It's a very visible decision.
And very stressful. Yeah. And so if you can help take that stress off, you're really doing a lot of good things. And then on the flip side, you've got to manage the deal the way you need to manage the deal to think about all the I's that you need to dot and the T's you need to cross. And if you don't do that earlier, it's going to bite you at the end.
Let me turn the tables and ask, what should the companies that our sales professionals work for, what can they do to make selling easier within their own organizations? How did they, because this is why I don't believe in sales enablement departments, because to my thinking, sales enablement is a culture. Either everyone's helping enable sales or anyone who's not is actually working against the selling effort. So what can companies do to have a more sales enablement culture and make it easier for salespeople to be successful?
Well, it goes back to a simple concept. Nothing happens until you sell something.
Yep.
And even though that's simplistic, and I'll leave that quote to Patrick Taylor of Oversight Systems, everybody has to be aligned. And, you know, there may be misaligned goals and objectives. It's really tough to sell a solution and then have your consultants come in behind the fact and, you know, truth to power. Their objectives are, can I extend the deal or can I extend the term or implementation? Let me get the first phase and I'll be back to do the next phase. So I think alignment has to be from the top down. I think the other aspect is a collateral positioning. And don't come up with collateral and positioning without involving your salespeople.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think from a sales management standpoint, you know, sales is a stressful job.
Mm-hmm.
Without a doubt, it's a stressful job. And if you're bringing your team back in after they've had a misstep in an account, and it's a pressure-sensitive situation as opposed to, hey, Clint, let's have fun with this. What do we do right and what do we do wrong? And let's do the wrong stuff and make fun of it.
Constructive ridicule.
Absolutely. And, you know, because then it takes the stress out of it. Okay, I made a mistake. I got it. Now I can, you know, the rest of the team is laughing about it. We're all laughing about it. And now we're going to go forward. And I don't feel so much stress on the next deal. I'm not panicking because
And by the way, you learned something.
Yep.
Without feeling bad about it.
Yeah. So it's really important not to put the stress of the sales management team or the sales manager back on the accounts or back on the frontline guys.
Now, how do you create that culture that enables the salesperson to ask for help and to be vulnerable in order to, you know, close the deal or take their kind of book of business to the next level?
I think it's real key for your sales manager to be known as someone who makes just as many mistakes as you do. In other words, I'm going to expose myself even more than what I'm asking you to expose yourself. So as long as you feel like I'm looking at my sales manager not as, you know, this hard mentor, but someone who has been there and done that and is laughing about, you know, here's what happened, here's what's going on. The most effective sales teams I've seen are just, they just love each other. And, you know, I can't say it any other way. They feel comfortable. It's a competitive environment, but it's not a stressfully competitive environment. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly.
But in your role now where you're coming in and advising, is that something you can see quickly? Is it like, what are kind of clues that they got that part right?
You can feel it because in the meeting, people are laughing, you know, enjoying being around each other. If you see a lot of heads down and people sighing and, you know, you're going, okay, well, this is a stressful environment. And how do you take the stress out so these people can learn? You can't learn in a stressful environment. I mean, go all the way back to college. You know, when you're stressing out for an exam, you did worse. When you were relaxed and, you know, a couple of beers in you, you were pretty good.
If they're telling stories like we three would be if we weren't, you know, on the radio, then it's a pretty relaxed environment.
It's a very relaxed environment. And we, at that time, we had a real relaxed environment.
We did. And, right.
Yeah, we had the first golf game ever. Remember that?
Yep.
It was the first golf game on a PC. And at the end of the day, I think half the sales team was out there, was in the conference room playing golf.
Right.
Or down at New York Pizza.
Right. One of the two.
Dropping quarters into the video machine.
But it was it's an environment where you learn, and I go back to how you learn. The person who makes a mistake knows they made a mistake, and pointing it out to them in a harsh and critical way doesn't help them understand the mistake any better, and it only makes them more anxious about making it again.
Yep.
And so if you can literally laugh it off and acknowledge that a mistake I've made, and even admit you made that mistake once in your life as well, then self-starting people who take responsibility, people who are self-motivated, they're going to fix that problem faster and better than you ever could through prescriptive guidance.
Well said.
And I think cadence and communication, really, there should be very few surprises.
Right.
If you have, you can lose a deal on your own, or you can win a deal on your own, but you can lose collectively, right?
So never lose alone.
Yeah.
Rule number one in selling.
Right, right. Yeah, so if you're going over the rails, grab the nearest object.
That's right. Take it with you.
Hopefully they can swim like heck.
Right. Great. Lee, anything else? You had any other questions?
No, this was great, and it's good to hear the different people at different stages sharing their kind of wisdom where they're at.
I really do appreciate you guys taking the time out of your days to spend with me and Lee here and to share your experiences and offer your advice to the listeners. It's been a great pleasure, and I really do appreciate you being here. Thank
you
very
much. More than
welcome. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Sales Effectiveness Radio, brought to you by the Semantics Group. To learn more and to listen to more episodes of Sales Effectiveness Radio, please go to semanticsgroup.com.